Hi, Aisha.
Hi. Okay, so let me just check if Mr. Galloway is available.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm just putting you through now.
Thank you.
Hello.
Oh, good morning. Sorry, good afternoon, George.
Yes, hello, George Galloway here.
Oh, hello, this is Arnold Levine calling from KOWS in California.
You're welcome.
Well, it's great to speak to you.
And you, my friend. You sound English.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Kentish Town in London.
Amazing. And so, now you're in California.
Yes, indeed. Lived here for a
while.
I wish I was in
California, my dear.
Oh, dear. Is the weather bad?
Oh, it's really bad. Oh, unbelievable.
It's really unbelievable. Yeah, it's one of those years this year, I think, all round.
Yeah, it's the worst winter in 35 years.
Oh, wow.
But anyway.
Well, great.
Where are you? Which part of California are you in?
We're just near San Francisco.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, we like
it. Mind you, as Mark Twain said, the coldest winter I ever spent was summer in San Francisco.
And he is absolutely true. That fog comes in and it goes right up your jumper.
That's right.
You know.
That's right.
So
anyway,
yeah.
Let's go. Let's fire away, yeah?
Okay, thank you very much. Of course, the most important thing everyone needs to know about a British guy is what tea do you drink and how do you drink it?
Well, I'm a coffee drinker, overwhelmingly. I could take or leave tea. No, I'm afraid that the coffee habit has well and truly crossed the Atlantic.
Oh, dear. Okay. Well, it keeps you going, I suppose. You have quite a schedule.
Indeed, yes. Mm-hmm.
So, you've had, let's say, quite a career so far, even.
Yes, I think I'd accentuate the word so far.
So far.
I'm 55. I'm up like a broom handle in the morning, as they say. I'm not planning on retiring anytime soon.
And we don't want you to, please. Just not enough voice. Obviously, here in America, we know you from regarding the Iraq War. But let's maybe go back how you got to that position. What inspired you to get into politics? Who inspired you?
I was born into politics, really. I was born into a political household. My father was a trade union official, and my mother, an Irish immigrant, whose family had rather trenchant views about the British Empire. When I told my Irish grandfather that the sun never set on the British Empire, according to one of our teachers, he said that's because God would never trust the British in the dark. And I never had cause to doubt him. So I was brought up in exactly such a household, and I was working in elections and so on from childhood. I mean, very young childhood, 5 or 6 years old.
Oh, wow. Going door to
door. So there was never any question that mine would be a political life. And by the grace of God, I've been able to spend the vast majority of my life being paid salaries for doing things that I would do for nothing.
Oh, that's beautiful. So a true vocation.
Yes.
Oh, that's beautiful. And so when did you first actually stand for Parliament?
I stood in 1987 and I won, defeating a very powerful figure called Roy Jenkins, who was a former Foreign Secretary, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, former Home Secretary. And a former president of the European Commission. So he was a very big man. But I defeated him in 87, and I've never lost any election since. I've been elected 5 times. I'm going now for the 6th. I'm one of those who quite likes elections, actually.
Yeah, you relish the that.
I relish the battle, yes.
Oh, beautiful. Now, that was in Glasgow.
In Glasgow in 87, yeah.
So, what was your constituency like, made up of?
Well, it was the West End of Glasgow, so it was a very highly educated constituency. It was known as the most educated constituency in Britain with the highest number of subscriptions to the magazine The New Statesman, which is, I suppose, the equivalent of your Nation. Is it The Nation?
Oh, yes.
Anyway, it was a very a thinking man's thinking man and woman's constituency. It contained no less than two universities and a world-class art school. So it had a lot of teachers, a lot of students. It was overwhelmingly white, virtually no Muslims, and I won it four times.
Mm. Beautiful. Now, that's interesting because when now that you are the MP for Bethnal Green and Bow, that's quite
it's a very very different. Yes.
So,
yes, it's a very, very different place.
Could you describe your constituency for our
My constituency is one of the poorest constituencies in England. It has some of the worst housing conditions. It has some of the lowest pay in England, being earned by some of the poorest people in England. And it has a gigantic minority ethnic community. Something like 50% of the constituents are from ethnic minorities, most of them Muslim, mainly Bengali, Bangladeshi.
Okay. Wow, so what a switch, yet you appeal to them as, to that constituency as well?
Yeah, it's a very different life now. Yeah. It's much harder because my constituents in East London have a lot of problems. Poverty brings a lot of problems in its wake, and I have problems to deal with now as an MP in London's East End that I could never have dreamt of as a Scottish MP. I mean, there is poverty in Scotland, and there are many other problems, but nothing remotely on the scale that the East End has.
Really, it is that different, because
it's only a mile from Westminster. You wouldn't believe it. And a mile, 100 yards from the City of London, the richest square mile on the earth. But we have 23,000 people on the housing waiting list.
Wow.
We have people living 12, 14 to a small flat, four, five, six sometimes in a room. We have very, very serious problems.
Oh, incredible. Are you learning any languages, any new languages?
No, I speak English and Arabic, and that gets me by.
Oh, okay. Oh, incredible. Now, in the House of Commons, a lot of Americans don't understand the process there. How do you get to actually stand up and speak? How are you picked, and how often do you get to speak?
Well, I spoke last week, and I had to sit for 6.5 hours in order to be chosen. And I was the last speaker chosen, so I could quite easily not have been spoken and therefore have sat for 6.5 hours in vain. There's a sort of unwritten magic at work when you've been in Parliament as long as I, almost a quarter of a century. You have a certain status, even if your political views are outside the mainstream. It cannot be ignored that you've been in Parliament so long, So, funnily enough, last week I made a speech, but it took me 6.5 hours to get in.
Wow. You have to keep yourself awake all that time.
Yeah, no toilet, no coffee, no smoke, nothing. 6.5 hours sitting, listening to other people speak.
Oh, you must have been fit to be tied at that point.
Yes, 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 yes.
And what did you speak about?
It was on proportional representation, reform of the voting system.
Hmm. I like that. We need some of that here.
Indeed you do.
There's no such thing as one man, one vote
over
here.
No.
So please let us know if there's a way to do that. Now, obviously, matter of interest, what side of the House do you actually sit in? Are you still sitting with the Labour government, or?
I sit on the opposition side of the House.
Oh, so you're sitting with the Conservatives and.
Not with the Conservatives, but on the same side of the House. No, I sit with a group of other independent-minded and independent MPs.
Hmm. And how many are there?
There's four.
Okay.
Five independent MPs.
Oh, okay, so...
And then there's the Scottish Nationalists and the Welsh Nationalists and the Irish Unionists and so on. So it's a very mixed side of the House.
Yeah, how are you on Scottish nationalism? I know it's been gaining...
I'm strongly against Scottish nationalism.
So you want to hold the...
I don't think that breaking up this small country in this small world would be a good idea.
Mm. Oh, that's an interesting approach.
Mm-hmm.
Not breaking up the union,
mm-hmm.
changing all those flags.
I just think nationalism leaves me cold in general. So whether British or Scottish.
Oh, okay.
My flag is red. My country is the future.
Oh, I like that. That's all we got. And now you came to prominence, obviously, because of the Iraq War. We started hearing about, obviously being dragged into the war back in 2003. You stood and you protested, which very few people did. Who else stood with you at that time?
Ah, well, we had 139 Labour MPs voted against the war. And we had the support of millions of people outside, so one was never lonely. But Parliament itself was a little bit of a bubble, I must say. And most of those who were with us before the war defected once the war started. So the Liberal Democrats, for example, were against the war before it started, but then declared once it had started they had to support it. So our numbers thinned rapidly once the war began. But even if there was only a handful of members of Parliament who were on our side, the vast majority of the people outside were on our side, so one was never lonely.
Oh, yeah, it's very different from America, unfortunately. The rush to war took most people with it, unfortunately.
Yes, although the American people somehow found their way to the truth through the fog of war propaganda and Fox News and so on.
Well, that's true. I mean, certainly myself and my friends could see what was happening. It wasn't a mystery to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's... But as we know what propaganda, it does work.
Mm-hmm, of course. Wouldn't be called propaganda if it didn't work.
Indeed. Now, I know you started the Stop the War Coalition with Tony Benn back then. How is that going?
Yeah. It's still going strong, unfortunately. Unfortunately, the wars that we formed to stop are still continuing.
Excuse me. And Tony Benn, he's an interesting... what an interesting... story he is, still going and still powerful.
Yes, he's old now, of course, but still clear and still our leader.
When I was growing up in London, I used to work in a hardware store when I was growing up, as a teenager and up in Highgate, and Dennis Healy used to come in.
He's still alive too, amazingly.
Really?
He is, yeah.
He's got to be close to 90
he's,
now.
He's over 90, yeah.
Mm.
It's better that a rich person should care about the poor than that they do not.
Well, that's true. And he almost became, the leader of the Labour Party at one
indeed.
Time.
Indeed. In fact, I think it would have been better if he had.
Mm. Interesting point.
If he had. Mm-hmm.
Over Callaghan, that would have been at the time, I suppose.
Over Foot.
Oh, Foot, right.
Mm.
Indeed. So,
the Foot leadership era was disastrous.
Yes, it sure was. Those 70s were not pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, With Iraq, have you been to Iraq recently?
No. I won't go to Iraq whilst it's occupied, no.
Okay, but you went there before the war then?
Indeed, many, many times, yeah.
Yeah. And when you, obviously, I know one of the main things when you were there was obviously the situation of the Iraqi people who were suffering. What is it like, from what you hear, what's it like now for the Iraqi people?
Well, everything is worse than it was before the war, and a million people lie dead. The hours of electricity, the hours of water supply, the infant mortality rates, the level of nutrition amongst children are all worse than they were before the war. Plus, there's a million dead people, so that all adds up to a bit of a disaster.
Yes, indeed, and obviously we're seeing a similar situation in Afghanistan. Obviously, we have this mini surge going on. What do you think of the war? What was your opinion of the war in Afghanistan after 9/11? And
well, I knew that it was doomed to last many, many years and to cost much blood and treasure, and so indeed it has. I made many speeches in Parliament at the time, saying that if we handled this, this atrocity of 9/11, if we handled it the wrong way, we would make thousands of new bin Ladens. And that's exactly what we have done. We've handled it the wrong way, and we've got thousands of new bin Ladens.
Yes, indeed. Do you see a way out?
The only way out is to get out.
Yeah.
And to allow the Afghans to develop a political solution of their own to their own country. We have legitimate interests that Afghanistan does not become a base for international terrorism and so on, but I believe that a deal along those lines is there to be done. Indeed, could have been done without all this war.
Hmm. Well, that's always the sad thing, isn't it? Looking at that and knowing there was a way and it wasn't taken.
Yeah, indeed. Jaw is better than war, as Mr. Churchill said.
That's right. Very true. Now, that obviously a different political stripe, but do you admire Churchill?
Yes. As a war leader, he's a real war leader, unlike the Bush and Blair, who've never faced an angry retort in their lives, but are ready to fight to the last drop of other people's blood.
And oil, yeah.
Yes.
And obviously, now, going back to before that war, obviously the whole Blair dodgy dossier and that whole lying way we got into the war at that time, did you have that information? Were you... telling everyone it was lies,
Yes, I follow the old adage of Claude Coburn, the father of Alexander and others, that nothing is true until it's officially denied, and that official information should be treated with grave skepticism. Instead, the media and the political class followed their leader over the edge of the cliff on a pack of lies.
Now, one of the things through this process, newspapers and other politicians and governments have thrown so much bad stuff at you, yet, you know, you've had a lot of lawsuits and you've actually won a lot of money from all the libel suits.
Well, I've never lost a lawsuit or I wouldn't be talking to you now, and that's because I've been determined to punish lies in the courts. And for someone with my politics, not easy to win cases in courts. Believe me, you only win them if the right is 100% on your side. No, dogs bark, the caravan moves on. Those who lied about me have had to pay very dearly in costs and in damages, millions of pounds. Over the years, I just see it all as part of the political battle, you know.
Yeah, the different weapons arrayed against you.
Yes, and uh, if you know, I'm ready to face any criticism. I'm ready to answer for anything I have actually done, or I have actually said, or I do actually believe. But I'm not prepared to allow people to tell brazen lies about me with the intention of reducing my political effectiveness.
Well, and you've been very effective in that. It's incredible.
I have. In the case of the allegations about Iraq, more than £2.5 million, so that's more than $4 million,
wow,
have been paid up.
Woo! Somebody's got deep pockets to keep to keep that,
yes,
coming.
Yes.
Do you, are you sort of like Private Eye? You're never happy unless you've got a lawsuit against you.
No, I haven't had a lawsuit for some time, and I'm hoping not to have any in the future, because I don't want people to tell lies about me.
Right. Well, maybe they've got the maybe they've got the picture.
Maybe they've got a message now. Yeah.
That's good. I'm sure you've got much better things to, you know, to spend your time on.
Indeed.
Than that. Now, in America, obviously, you came to great prominence when you came in front of the Senate committee meeting.
Yes.
In 2005, the oil for food.
Yes.
Now, I've, you know, read your book, you know, George Galloway Goes to Washington, and it's such a tour de force.
Thank you. I never did get paid for that book. Did it sell any copies?
I believe so. Over here it did, actually, yeah. You should
yeah,
ask
it was
them.
Only an American. It wasn't published here. It was only in the United States.
Oh, okay. No, I believe a number of people have got it.
I must check out what happened to the royalties on that.
Indeed. It may have stayed over here, yeah.
Indeed, yes.
It's interesting, reading it and listening to it. Do you think your parliamentary debating background sort of gave you an advantage over the more sort of collegial Senate process?
Well, up to a point. Certainly British people like to believe that. And it's true up to a point. But there are not many good debaters in the British House of Commons nowadays.
Mm.
I think more germane was the fact that the U.S. Senate has become used to being virtually royal, a kind of Camelot, court of King Arthur. No one ever really talks to them in the way that I talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
They're like a sort of group of princes who are treated absolutely deferentially. And that, of course, didn't happen with me. So, I, as George Bush would put it, I think they misunderestimated me.
Beautiful. Yeah, well, he's good for one thing, at least, silly quotes, yeah.
Indeed, yes.
Now, obviously, happening right now is the Iraq inquiry in England, in Britain. And what do you think of that? Obviously, it seems to be a lot of whitewash. Everyone's just obviously not, doesn't appear to be telling the truth on a lot of ways on protecting...
The Iraq inquiry? Well, on the principle that even a stopped clock is right twice a day, the Chilcot inquiry is producing some information that would otherwise not have been out in the public domain yet, making politicians uncomfortable, at least... for a day. Mr. Blair had quite an easy ride. Mm-hmm. Mr. Brown next week will probably have a less easy ride. Mm. And in general, it's keeping the Iraq issue, you know, quite prominently to the fore in the British political scene. And I'm glad myself about that. It's very important that these people don't get away scot-free with what they did.
Exactly. And will you be called to the inquiry?
No. I've offered myself, but they don't want to hear from me.
Oh, I wonder why.
Indeed.
And,
perhaps they've seen the video of the Senate appearance.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm. And, you know, so many things, you know, keep coming out, like, you know, the Chalabi thing, you know, just... things that were so obvious at the time, even. I'm still amazed that people are still sort of defending those positions about...
Yeah, I'm not sure how many... Well, I don't know what it's like in your country, but in ours, you won't find many people defending it now. And Chalabi can't win a seat in the Iraqi parliament. He's an absolutely discredited person. It's a pity that a million people had to leave their guts on the streets of Iraq in order to bring about that discrediting.
Well, exactly. That's the sad thing. Again, it's sad when you look at things and you know they're wrong, but you know, you just feel powerless. How do you change so many minds?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is a couple.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you fight, you can't guarantee that you're going to win, but if you don't fight, you can guarantee you're going to lose. So that's the way I look at it.
Right. Indeed. And of course, we have Iran now looming. Everyone trying to jockey it into the same place.
Yes, it's the same old. It's the same drumbeat headed in the same direction. But if we're fool enough to allow it to happen, we'll spend a long time regretting it. I promise you that. Iran is a very strong and vibrant country. It's not a broken-backed country bled white by 20 years of sanctions and war. Iran is well able to respond to any military attack against it, and respond, I'm certain, that it will.
Yeah, it's just the whole demonizing. I mean, obviously, there's bad stuff going on, but again, the demonizing, it seems a direct thing.
Well, that's right. There's a full-scale effort on many levels being made to isolate and weaken and divide Iran. But I don't think fundamentally it's going to work. I don't think the Islamic revolution in Iran is going to be defeated. I think an attack on Iran by Israel or the United States or both is likely to strengthen the hand of the regime rather than weaken it. So it's very foolish on many, many levels.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, obviously, the whole Israel thing with they've obviously retaliated against Syria, against Iraq for nuclear work. So everyone seems to think that that will just happen again with Iran. But
well, I don't think that any strike can be decisive in that regard. I think that the Iranian nuclear program is very highly developed, it's very highly dispersed, and it's very large in quantity, in quantum. So I don't think that any strike can succeed to destroy Iran's nuclear energy capability. So it will be even more foolhardy. It will not achieve the goal, but it will create war throughout the world.
Right. Exactly. It will just proliferate even more.
Indeed.
Yeah. Now, obviously, we have new... for a year, we've had a new president and leader. What's your assessment of Obama, President Obama?
Well, he's been very disappointing, I must say. I supported him long before most people in this country could pronounce his name. Mm. I supported him throughout the primary process on my radio shows, on my TV shows. I argued with people on the left in the United States that they should support him and so on, but I'm afraid he's been a pretty big disappointment. If I look at the area of the world in which I'm most involved, in the Middle East, he's broken 300 million hearts. In the Arab world, he gave a speech in Cairo which was mesmerically, captivatingly hopeful. But everything that has happened since then has been to smash those hopes into pieces. So, and I'm not sure that he's done terribly well on the domestic front either, and must be in very real danger of being a one-term president, and that would be very, very sad indeed.
Well, yes, indeed. Obviously, there's a lot of us getting very, very, very disappointed. his State of the Union address was a disaster, in my opinion. The first words out of his mouth coming nuclear energy and more oil and more clean coal.
Well, I think he's he's disappointed a lot of the people who supported him, and the people who opposed him have become ever more virulent and a little bit dangerous, if you ask me, in their hatred of him. Mm-hmm. It's not a good situation that he's in now.
So really, he's done it. Certainly what we're thinking, he really hasn't used the power that he had at that when he came into power. It seems like he has squandered it to us.
Yes, I think that's right. He had the whole world at his side. He had the whole world in his hands, and he squandered the opportunity.
Again, maybe it's going back to that about the Senate, that they're so coddled in there that they don't really see the world properly? Or...
Well, it's particularly disappointing because Obama is such a very clever man. He's probably the best educated, most clever president the United States has ever had. So he doesn't have the alibi that the last guy had of being an idiot.
Right. Exactly. He's coming from a different place. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do we do in America? Do you have any suggestions?
That's not my business. my name is George. I'm not here to recolonize you. No, I'm afraid you have to find your own path. Enough trouble here.
We have a few people, who obviously stand out, like Dennis Kucinich and Barbara Lee and Cindy Sheehan. We have so few who are really putting their head above the parapet.
Well, I have spent quite a lot of time in the U.S. in the last year and a half. I've made more than 50 speeches in the U.S. in the last 18 months, and I'll be coming back to do more after the election, one way or another. So I'm doing my best to try and bring together people in support of Palestine in Viva Palestina USA. So I'll be heading your way within a few months, I hope.
Oh, excellent. You have no problem getting in with visas and like...
No, not at all.
Oh, good. And, talking about the Palestinian-Israeli situation, how do you see that? How do you see that moving ahead with Netanyahu in power now?
Well, it's not moving ahead. It's moving backwards.
Oh.
Any problem for whom the solution was Benjamin Netanyahu is simply unimaginable. Mm-hmm. After 22 days of murderous aggression during the recent Gaza war, the Israeli electorate threw out the war criminals and elected a government even worse than the one that had been doing the bombardment. So I'm afraid there's not much hope of the Israeli government taking the necessary measures to return this whole process to a track which might lead somewhere. But on the principle that a surgeon cannot operate on his own foot, I'm afraid that whoever was in power in Israel would not be able to be depended upon to do that. This will have to be done from outside, and in particular it has to be done from the United States, which pays the bills of Netanyahu and any other Israeli leader, all other Israeli leaders. And if Israel isn't forced to pay the price, which is the necessary price for peace, which is justice for the Palestinians, then why should it? And it never will. So it has to be forced. And it has to be forced by the people who pay its bills. And that's us, to a certain extent, but overwhelmingly it's you.
Right. We pay the big bucks, $7 billion a year or whatever it is.
Indeed. Now, my friend, I'm going to have to draw this to a close, I'm afraid. So maybe one more question.
Okay. Quick one about the next election coming up. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, the current level of the opinion polls is that the parliament will be a hung parliament. That means no overall majority for any party. And that's quite a change, actually, from the feeling over the last couple of years that the Conservatives were definitely on their way back. They may well be the biggest party, but it's by no means certain that they will be, and it's looking increasingly less likely that they will have an overall majority. So I hope to be in the next parliament, because if it is a hung parliament, with a bit of luck, it'll be hung around me, and I'll decide item by item on the whether or not to support the government's program. That would be a dream come true. But it's going to be, politics going to be interesting in Britain in the next 5 years.
Yes, I hope so. And I hope you keep making it that way.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you so much, George Galloway.
All the best. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye now. Bye.